Welcome back to another episode of the Grief Observed podcast. I'm Brad Morrell, your host. If you would like to join me for an episode, find me on Facebook at facebook.com/griefobservedpodcast or send me an email at griefobservedpodcast@gmail.com. I'll have the email in the show description. On today's episode, I have a special guest with me. You may recall on episode 40, I had Kelly Daugherty, who co-authored a book called The Grief Experience with many other great authors. And today I have one of those authors with me. My guest is Julie Funkhauser, and Julie's an author, a co-founder of Recovery Connection, and tells her own personal story today with us, a little bit about her loss and just speaking about the loss of her husband. So welcome, Julie, and I'll just shut up for a minute and step out of the way, and you can tell people who you are and a little bit more about just who you are.
Thank you. Thank you, Brad, so much for having me, and thank you for the work that you do on this podcast. You know, grief is something that touches all of us along our life journeys, and it's a really hard topic, really uncomfortable and really heavy. So thank you for continuing to shine a light on the topic so people feel safe to lean into it. I am a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. It doesn't define who I am in my essence, and it's a huge part of my why, my story. And so I usually kind of start off by saying that. Actually, this week I celebrated 16 years free from addiction, any mind-altering substances, which was pretty incredible, and also, I guess, discloses that I am relatively old. So to have 16 years, but that's okay. I'm also a co-founder and chief executive officer of a program here in Winchester, Virginia, called the Recovery Connection. My best friend, Meredith, and I, who is actually a co-author of a different book called Brave Kids, not The Grief Experience, but she's also a published author too. She and I opened and have grown and expanded a program for women that is trauma-informed and holistically focused, serving the Medicaid population here in the state of Virginia. It has been our passion to, you know, we are both in long-term recovery. She has 15 years. So, you know, together with our passions in the field and in helping others has kind of been our driving force, in the many evolutions of TRC. And where we are today is we have two residential properties in an outpatient location, and, you know, do all kinds of beautiful things. You know, we focus obviously on more traditional psychotherapy, group and individual, medication management, you know, overall life skills support, some peer work, and then holistic healing. So yoga, breath work, Reiki, all of that good stuff. It's, you know, serving the indigent population is a passion of she and I's, being able to help these women feel seen and heard, sometimes for the first time in their lives. They've all experienced, you know, it's an overgeneralization, but can confidently say most, if not all, of the women we have served have had elements of trauma over the course of their life. So that is, you know, a little bit about my professional life, you know, a little bit of the personal end of things. I'm a mom of two. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and my son will be 7 next week. And I also am a widow, you know, and that's kind of to lead into the book. In my chapter, lost my late husband, Danny, September 11th of 2018, less than 2 weeks after opening the Recovery Connection, to the disease of addiction, through an overdose. And, you know, the last 5+ years, going on 6 years, has, you know, the grief journey for me has a lot of mirrored type of experiences as like when entering early recovery, you know, this like big roller coaster up and down. extreme experience of emotion. You know, so I connect a lot, you know, with other folks who have lost a loved one, especially those due to overdose, and, you know, kind of compare it to the journey of recovery. You know, my chapter really talks a lot about the power of release, finding ways to get it out, get it out, release it, and how, you know, by doing that, we kind of clear out that heart space to create a pure portal to in finding depth in our relationships with ourselves, others, you know, a higher power in the world around us. And it kind of walks through my whole journey. And just like to close it up, I know we're going to spend more time together on the call, but, you know, to kind of close it up in our most dark times, and when we're willing to rumble in, you know, the unimaginable pain of grief, to kind of clear it, dig in there, transmute it, to experience a more depth of love and abundance of connection, you know, we can have beautiful gifts. Like, there is hope on the end of it. And, you know, my life today is far beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I'm engaged to an incredible human being, now have 5 children and not 2, you know, combined together, we have 5. And just the depth of relationship and the depth of empathy and compassion and faith that I feel as a result of, you know, moving in the grief journey is pretty profound. So I've done a lot of rambling, but I took you like very high level across the course of my general life path. So yeah.
No, that's great. Excellent intro. And I do have a lot of extra questions. So first of all, let me say congratulations on 16 years of being free from addiction. That's huge. And I've had other people come on the show where they have lost someone to addiction. So I feel like it's something that's very important in the area that I'm in. There is a lot of, you know, we've had kind of that whole opioid crisis thing, and it still exists. And now I think more than anything, fentanyl is probably the biggest addiction that kills in this area. Like, it is just unbelievable. And I talk with people who have lost family members to fentanyl and other drugs or alcohol. Like, it's, and of course, addiction can be lots of things, but when you're talking about something that can kill you, it takes on a whole different meaning, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's not to downplay anyone else's addiction or anything. It's, but I always state that we're all addicted to something in life, even if it's chocolate candy, right? And there may not be a ton of harm in chocolate candy, but I think people can relate in their own ways. But I think whenever we're talking about substance use disorders, it's different. So you stated that you've been clean for 16 years from addiction. How long did you struggle with that?
So it's similarly, you know, kind of, you touched on it, you know, it's not just necessarily about the drugs, you know? So when I share my story, I picked up alcohol and drugs, you know, for me, first it was alcohol at age 14. You know, but my disease was kind of working on me a little bit before I ever picked up. You know, there's no like addiction gene of being able to identify like, hey, this person is going to be addicted to drugs, or this person's going to be an alcoholic or whatever. But there are like vulnerabilities. And across a lot of my childhood, I was super shy and like insecure. I got picked on a lot. I was overweight kind of as a kid in like late elementary school, middle school. And I was, you know, kind of taunted and bullied, and it had a profound impact on me. Like, I was already kind of not feeling so good about myself. And then, you know, I have kids around me at an age where it's so important to be cool and fit in, you know, call me names. And, you know, I didn't have the confidence to stand up for myself or the ability to use my voice. And so before I ever picked up a drink or a drug, my disease, you know, and obsession and compulsion kind of manifested in an eating disorder at age 12. And that was something that I picked up first and then one of the last things I put down. So, you know, I started struggling with restriction, a little bit of anorexia that developed into bulimia, and it kind of rode alongside my drug and alcohol addiction the entire time. And then when I got clean and sober in 2008, I picked the eating disorder up full force, you know, because it was like kind of like swapping one out for another. And then, you know, my eating disorder recovery journey kind of started a couple years after putting the drugs and alcohol down. But I say all that to say, you know, I picked up substances in freshman year, you know, really for the sole purpose of like I needed kids around me to validate me because I didn't feel good enough on my own accord. And a lot of that had to do with just like how I felt about me being picked on, you know, and my overall personality. Like I was just shy. And so I got connected to people who were doing things that like I just wanted to be cool, you know, kind of like the textbook did it to fit in. The difference, and I don't know if anybody who doesn't struggle with addiction feels this way, but I remember like the first time I was under the influence, I just like felt calm, like my mind finally went quiet. I wasn't like I felt comfortable in my own skin. I felt like confident. You know, it was like this feeling that I was desperately seeking, you know, that I couldn't find because I needed your validation. Well, once I got drunk or once I was under the influence of something, I didn't feel so compelled to get your validation because I was, you know, impacted. You know, I was drunk or I was so. That kind of kicked it off for me. And so I started freshman year.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look for something that will either turn their mind off or will give them some sense of control. And that's where most addictions are formed. You know, it may be the first time that I do feel in control of my life. Everything else can stay chaotic because I can't control, you know, this or that, but this is my peace. I won't camp out there, but I do want to dig into the book a little bit now that I've got a copy. And thank you, Kelly, for sending me a copy to review. And I will state that I'm still only about 5 or 6 chapters in because I've been reading other stuff, and I will finish. But your story was chapter two, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to contact her. This was awesome, and I connected. I do want to read a couple of things, just a couple of brief quotes from the book that kind of drew me in. The first one, literally second paragraph, says, "I know my mind tries to keep me safe. It wants to plan and project the next 18 moves in front of me to prepare for the 27 possibilities of things that could happen, leading to the loss of someone or something I love." And I'm like, oh wow, I really connect to that. And again, it's I can almost hear that piece of I would love to have some control, or you know, thoughts of thinking that I can change the outcome as long as I stay ahead of the game.
That's right.
And I, you know, a lot of deaths occur absolutely being just surprised. You know, before we started our call, I told you about my friend Chad that passed away 12 years ago. Completely unexpected. You know, you can see this is my music room as well as a podcast studio. And Chad and I had written 6 songs together that year. I saw him on Sunday, Tuesday, he was gone. And it's like, what do I do with this? There's no way I would have seen it coming. He seemed to be a healthy man and just dropped dead of a heart issue, a genetic thing that he had no idea about at 38 years old. I won't camp out there either. I want to talk about your story. And you stated September 11th of 2018, you get a knock on the door. Tell me about it.
I had just opened the Recovery Connection, with my best friend. I mean, we're We opened September 1st. You know, I think we had one home, and I think we had literally one client. And I mean, it was quiet, and you know, the week, well, really, the 2 years on and off leading up to that point. You know, I had met my late husband Danny in the rooms of recovery. And he had almost 6 years, you know, he was really an integral part of the community, the recovery community. And, you know, everybody's story is different, and relapse absolutely is a lot of the times a part of somebody's story. And, you know, for him, he struggled with co-occurring mental health, bipolar disorder that, you know, I watched it impact him significantly. He started to abuse his own psychiatric medication. And so, you know, that was kind of like the first lapse. And then over the course of the next 2 years, it was just kind of on and off. And I never really saw him buy back in to what he was doing in those first 6 years. I mean, he'd give it a shot. And a lot of the times, you know, you can almost sense like he was doing it to appease me, or to appease like his internal buy-in. Just, it never latched back on. And that's not to say, you know, that people can't enter into recovery with a motivation for doing it for somebody else, because that can shift over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I honestly, like I entered recovery in 2008 because, well, I was scared to die, but I also like had nothing, you know, I would like had nowhere to live. And I was like, well, crap, this stinks. You know, I'm 20 years old. And so like my motivation, I'm not like, I can't say like I was ready and done and never wanted to use again. I absolutely was thinking about using again, but I took it one day at a time and things started to shift for me. So I just say that for anybody who might be listening and, you know, navigating recovery, and their intentions may not be purely like, I want to stop forever. Like, that's okay. You know, you can still recover and have those thoughts. But anyways, and he, you know, just like a few months here, relapse, couple months here, relapse, couple, you know, and it kind of just progressed. The week leading up to 9/11, you know, he had essentially gotten like had a drug induced psychosis, was having delusions, paranoia. And, you know, I won't get into detail about that. But I will say, you know, events leading up to his passing were indicative of like significant gaps in our behavioral healthcare system. And kind of took me on my own journey with state and federal advocacy around legislation, which was a really powerful journey. And, you know, I'm not as involved as I used to be. It served its purpose in that season to like channel my anger and my rage, and, you know, and my healing journey have really quieted in those emotions. And so I'm not feeling as charged in that, but, you know, I'll never forget. I mean, I hadn't seen him in a day and a half. You know, I didn't know where he was. You know, I heard like three loud, like giant knock at the door. And anybody that is in recovery knows what the cop knock sounds like. It's like boom, 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 you know? And so I'm, you know, new into my program, and I see a police officer. I'm thinking, oh shoot, you know, the client that we have, maybe there's an issue with her. Then I also remember thinking, okay, he's gotten arrested, you know, like he's safe. Like that's where my mind was going. And I opened the door and I look, and my mom's standing there. And, you know, my mom had known all the chaos of the week leading up to it. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, like it just happened so fast. Like I didn't compute anything. And I'm like, okay, mom came. Maybe she's here because life's crazy right now, you know, like, and I remember him saying, you know, your husband passed away. And it was like in a second, I'm on the floor and my legs just buckled. And I remember screaming, no, like literally all I could say was no, you know, and our house manager at the time was there. The client was there. My mom was there. And I just remember them all holding me, and lifting me up. because I couldn't walk. And just like, I can't explain it because I don't think it can be explained, but when I say it, I know that those who know grief know what I mean. The world looked different after that. It was just, and
Yeah,
it's never
one.
looked the same since that moment, you know?
Was going to say one other highlight I've got here I wanted to read. And you basically stated Danny's death shook me more alive, more awake, and more connected than I ever thought possible. I became a new person that day. I didn't know it at the time, but this was to be the cornerstone of my own spiritual transformation. This was my rebirth. So, like you stated, it's your world changed in an instant, but it's never looked the same since, right?
No, I'm not the same person that I was. And it's still, you know, I still get emotional. Obviously, of course.
Sure.
I think I'll say I feel. I'm a deep feeler. You know, my friends, we kind of joke about, you know, there goes Julie again. I feel so deeply because I've known loss so profoundly. You know, it's kind of like, and I wouldn't want to be any other way. You know, I'm super just, I guess it's an empath part of me.
Guilty.
Yeah, I know, super sensitive to any shift of energy, like anything. So still learning how to navigate that, by the way. And you know, I can't possibly know and understand, and like I don't believe I'm meant to fully comprehend the why behind it all. It'll all make sense when I get to where I'm going, and I'm not gonna worry about that today or in this moment. What I do know is I can look back and reflect and see that I was held and carried across a total transformational season of my life and continue to be. I mean, really catapulted me into the next era, if you will, of my life, and you know, really deepened my connection with a higher power, and guided me to all kinds of different experiences. And I started to have my own direct experiences energetically, and you know, started to dive into Reiki, and have been practicing Reiki ever since. Like yoga, in my training to be a yoga teacher, you know, breath work, meditation, because I felt so divinely connected to the God of my understanding in all of this, and felt so deeply connected to Danny too. I mean, like there were signs very early on, that he was around and he was communicating, and like they were absolutely undeniable. And you know that, and I've continue every so often, you know, it's much quieter now. You know, he, I believe, has stepped back and you know, wants me to, it's like, okay, you know, you're good. But we'll drop in and visit the kids sometimes too. But yeah, it has changed who I am, and in a very positive way, you know. I feel, and I can experience gratitude in that. You know, I kind of hesitate in wording that because it's like I'm not, of course, grateful for what happened, you know. So, but I think you know what I mean in that, like in looking at in the depths of hell, for lack of a better word, in the grief experience, the beauty, in transformation of the way that I look at life, the way I like my ability to practice empathy with other humans has profoundly shifted. You know, like I am not nearly as judgmental as I used to be. I am not like I just seek to understand everything around me and choose to not always because I'm a human and but much more like there is light in the darkness and everything, and there is a lesson to be shown in everything if we choose to see it that way.
Yeah,
So
you know, you're talking about you're not thankful for what happened, but you're thankful for the things thereafter, and that's part of meaning making through grief. And so I love to hear a person's changed life after someone else's death. Yeah. One thing I did want to mention, and I think it was really the piece that really drew me into your story, was a conversation you were having with your daughter when she was 4 years old. And you said she's 10 now, so yeah, that's quite a jump. But the one thing that I really enjoyed about your story was the fact that you could be real with your daughter. And I think that so often we try to protect our children and try to make them maybe believe things that aren't completely accurate when it comes to death. Yeah. But one of your quotes was you were telling yourself, show her it's okay. Show her it's okay to feel this. And then you said tears flowed down your cheeks. And I love that part, just because you were being real with your daughter. Now, obviously, a four-year-old can't understand everything, but you were allowing her to see that it's okay to cry, you know? And I think a lot of times we teach kids, you know, not to cry or things like that. But correct me if I'm wrong. You wrote a book a lot about this. Is that where, is it Brave Kids? Is that what it's called? Okay. So tell me a little bit about Brave Kids and just how that came about.
Well, thank you for that. So I'm also a co-author in Brave Kids, and, you know, not all about grief. It's a children's book kind of directed kids ages 9 to 12. Some of the stories are like 6 to 9, the way that they're written. Same thing, 24 to 25 authors. And the stories are highlighting acts of bravery, you know, whether it's through, like, for in my story, it's my daughter Riley's journey of grief and her bravery and allowing herself to feel and let the grief out, and how brave that is instead of stuffing it. You know, because in the beginning and in her life, you know, she kind of, as a couple of years started to go by, would just kind of swallow it down, and it kind of started to manifest itself like in physical symptoms, right? You know, everything's connected. If we're stressed, we're going to have back pain, or we're going to, you know, we're going to hold it in different things. Like, a lot of anxiety creates tummy problems. And so, you know, she would get chronic stomach aches and, like lump, you know, lumps in the throat. And I identify with that very much. And, it's just generally speaking, you know, her journey of allowing herself to release it. You know, a lot of alignment of the overall energy of my chapter and the grief experience and letting myself, you know, let it out. But, you know, the cool thing about what I love about that story is it highlights her tremendous bravery. And, the way that I had written it, we, you know, it was like right around when she kind of allowed herself to really have a solid, good release. And, you know, very shortly, the story is a teensy bit different. It was right around that time. A feather, a huge, huge feather just bloop on the ground, like just came out of nowhere. And obviously we knew, you know, we were like, okay, all right, this is how Dad sends his signs. It's feathers. You know, it was kind of like a declaration that I felt immediately from him, of him saying, guys, this is me saying hi. This is how I'm going to tell you. This is what you're going to see, you know? And from that point forward, we would be talking about him, or we would be sad about him, or we would literally be inside. Like, I think one time we were walking in the mall, in a mall, like indoor mall. And it was like, boop, you know, just like these beautiful experiences. And we were able to create like a fun connection point for the kids. So, you know, the kids now to this day, even, you know, my son who was 17 months and, you know, really didn't know him, when he sees a big feather, he's like, it's Daddy, you know? And so we've been able to create that spiritual connection, with their dad through feathers. And it was in Riley releasing, you know, that kind of opened her up for her and me releasing to receive the sign. Cause I believe, you know, if we're all blocked up and stuffing it, it's like we're tunnel vision. We can't open up our energy to feel it and receive it. And it was in the courage of letting the emotion out that kind of cleared us out to be able to see it. So.
Yeah, I definitely believe in getting the bad stuff out. I had a professor in college years ago. He said, we're trying to pick the weeds out, but if you just simply pick the weeds out, then the weeds will grow back because you've left a lot of room. But if you pick the weeds out and plant the good stuff, then the weeds don't have room to grow back. And I'm like, that's pretty good. So
There
the one thing I like about the Grief Experience book is the fact that everybody has given a tool that's meaningful to them. And yours is talking about visualization meditation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Visualization meditation was really powerful for me. After losing Danny, and I started to kind of explore yoga, breath work, Reiki, really practicing and having these experiences energetically. And so, I really didn't even, I was in meditation after a yoga practice, like Shavasana, and just kind of lay in there. And I could sense and feel kind of like this muck and this almost like for me, like this wet clay, like murky in my heart space. And so I just kind of like intuitively started breathing white light in and out and feeling it clear. And I had a very profound emotional experience. And I felt so much lighter, afterwards. And so I think for me, yeah, I do really good with guided meditations. Sometimes, I mean, I can drop in and connect with nothing now, but not in the beginning. I couldn't. I needed somebody to tell me how to breathe, tell me what to look at, tell me what to tune into. And so I wanted to provide something that folks can visualize to support the experience of clearing or cleansing. And it's, and then, when I started to kind of like feel into that practice, I was like, oh, this is awesome. And I prayed for some guidance about how to expand on that and create it. 'Cause this was, I think, during the time of writing the chapter. Or it might have been, I think it was a little bit before, Kelly asked me to participate in the project when that meditation came in, but to kind of like finalize it. Just kind of prayed for guidance on finishing it. But it sounds really like abstract and woo-woo, but there's something so powerful about whether it's creative expression through journaling, visualization, breath work, anything that creates an experience of getting something out of here and out of us, whether it's through breathing out, exhalation, visualization of clearing, like writing, it truly does clear out congestion, or stagnant energy in the body. And so, I hope that people are finding it useful.
Yeah, I had a client this past week that spoke of a really profound guided meditation that they did, and I don't know, it's really interesting what people see in those moments or what they feel. And like you stated, I feel like the more of the stuff that we get out of us, and it's not always bad stuff, but I think getting it out does allow more room for us to take in the good stuff. Tell me a little bit more about you said that you have been forever changed. And I think a lot of people go most of their lives without knowing who they are. For me, I'll be 49 in October. I was about 44 when it's like, I know my purpose now. I know what I'm supposed to do. I just feel like a lot of people either don't look for it or they're just not seeing the signs. How did your life change?
Well, it talks about it in the chapter of how, I talk about my elliptical. My elliptical became like my first release tool. I needed a tool in the beginning to let me and help me learn how to release, cleanse, clear. And in doing that, I would find these pockets of peace and breath. And so I just, being the good addict that I am, got addicted to that feeling. because that feeling far outweighed any high on a drink or a drug, you know? And so I just chased that really, and really catapulted me on this like wild spiritual journey. What has happened to me in the course of that, and it has not been a linear journey. Nothing ever is, you know. I'm a human being. I have an ego. I can very much get caught up in things that aren't as, you know, important. But generally speaking, you know, the loss of a spouse and the father of my kids, you know, my whole, everything got ripped out from under me. You know, it was like everything changed. I went on a journey of self-love, you know, like becoming a single mom and a widow in a millisecond of time, you know. I had to learn how to be a single mom and kind of do it all on my own. And not, you know, that was one of the most profound things. I wasn't alone. I was carried. I was carried by my family, my friends, and truth, an entire community. And I started sharing his story. I started feeling compelled to just share my grief journey and dove into advocacy and, you know, just got some legislation passed. And I was noticing and starting to feel like by me sharing my truth from a place of like pure raw love, it was inspiring hope in people. And it was generating, you know, I ended up having like 3,000 people on this page for advocacy and started to get more involved and was realizing that like people connect with real, you know? And so I took people on the journey with me and it had a profound impact. And, you know, the longer and the deeper I go in my own spiritual journey of self-love and healing, realizing and further confirmed that, you know, God is love and love is the answer. And to all things, you know, any question that exists in the universe, that love is the answer. And so, you know, I truly, and the ways that I show up in my life may ebb and flow over time and in, you know, what I do. And, but I truly believe my purpose is to love and, you know, to spread love and be love. And I think that that's all, you know, what we're here to do. And so in any way that I can do that, I believe is my life's purpose is to be the light and to spread the light. And what that means is to heal, you know, like continuing to heal layer by layer by layer, peeling the onion, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, the Beatles already beat you to the song. All we need is love, right?
Yes.
What would you say to someone who has gone through a significant loss and maybe feels like life as they know it is over? What would you say to them?
Ooh, that's a powerful question. And a lot of the times what I say when, you know, there's someone around me or close to me that has experienced loss, like what I feel often called to say is that there is nothing to say. You know, there's no words, like there's nothing that I can say here right now, you know, on this podcast that's going to minimize the amount of pain that someone is feeling. There's no profound magic words, you know. Depending on where I was in any millisecond of time, somebody could tell me one day, you know, it'll get better in time and I'll connect to that and lean into that. But then they could tell me 10 seconds later, the same thing. And I could be angry and resentful that they said that, you know, so there's nothing that can take away where people are in the present moment. And I guess what I feel called to say is that life will always be different, you know, and that, you know, the whole intention behind this book, The Grief Experience, is to inspire hope, you know, is to instill just, even if it's just a tiny shimmer of hope that, okay, these are all authors who have had a deep connection to grief. And by picking up this book and reading it, I'm reading the stories of folks whose at one point they felt life was over, but clearly it's not, because they're writing this chapter to try to help me. So, you know, just trying to find, similarly to, you know, the journey of recovery, it's kind of like, I thought like there was no way that I could recover from drugs and alcohol, but then I went to a meeting and I saw somebody pick up, you know, 6 months, or I saw somebody celebrate a year. You know, it was like the power of the peer, people who know, and we don't have to know how, you know, even if we kind of buy on the faith of our peers, like I may not believe it, but they believe it for me. So I'll hang on to that. Sometimes what we got.
Yeah, I think sometimes when we feel like we have to be the one to pioneer or pave a road, you know, it's like, well, I don't have the energy to do that. And I'm not even sure it can be done. Right. But if we see someone who's been down a similar path, that's like, wow, that person does have, you know, 1 year, 3 years recovery. And, you know, here you're stating I've got 16 years. So I'm certain that that does give a lot of people hope and energy to keep moving. And sometimes it takes just that first step, you know, and I think reaching out to others is a huge piece, you know, whether it is family, you know, family, friends, a therapist, whatever, whether it is, you know, addiction or grief or whatever. The biggest thing is, and this kind of keys back in on your love piece, that life is not meant to be lived alone. You know, I think we have to partner with others in recovery and just day-to-day life.
I kind of what I always say to somebody who's experienced loss is, there are no words to capture this. Just know that you are loved and held, you know, like holding space for somebody and just saying, there's nothing that can be said, but I see you, you know? And that was, you know, I'll share on this briefly. That was an experience that I had that I know after talking to other people, because I, you know, learned from other people too. And along the way, I've had conversations, you know, on their grief journey, like the silence after the funeral. You know, there's so much energy, like right in the immediate loss, right? Like when it's powerful and it's busy and all of your energy is being put into the funeral and arrangements and blah, 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 blah. And it's painful and it's awful and you melt down and you break down all day, every day. And you've got people caring. You've got 50 texts in your inbox. You've got people showing up, sending food, blah, 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 blah. And then you have the funeral, and then and it's not intentional. You know, it's not like there's anything malicious about this experience or anybody's intentions, but, you know, from an outsider or somebody who isn't immediate in the situation, okay, I attended the funeral, go back to my life, you know?
Yes.
So then I felt that profoundly. I felt like it's almost like I literally heard the silence. I can't explain it. It was like, where is it? And that's an over exaggeration, because there were people that, you know, my parents lived with me for a month, you know? So like I wasn't alone, but it was such a drastic change from like up until the funeral and then after the funeral. And so, you know, I think it's important, because grief doesn't end, you know, that we continue to kind of check in, you know, whether it's 2 months, 3 months, whatever, in whatever capacity we feel called to. But I think it's important, like, you know, the darkest parts for me was after the funeral, you know, it was when things felt very quiet and everybody else's lives went back to normal, you know, and mine was different. So,
yeah, I've stated on this podcast several times that I want to write a book about the 100 dumbest things I've heard at funerals, or write a book called After the Last Casserole Is Gone. And you actually mentioned casseroles, you know, you said your fridge was full, but you know, there is an awkward silence. Like once people go back to their normal lives and yours never goes back to normal. And I put that in quotations. Normal is highly subjective anyway, right?
Absolutely. Yes. I like that idea, after the last casserole, because it was just such a, it was very powerful. And I remember being angry, and bitter and having just like resentful thoughts. And it all belongs. I think also giving permission to allow whatever's coming up for us to come up, even if it's bogus, or if it rationally seems bogus. It's like, okay, yeah, but like give it permission to be there, because we need to validate what's coming up and giving permission. So,
Yeah. Well, Julie, I'm going to respect your time. I know you have other obligations, but I thank you for being with us here on the podcast. And I at least want to give you any final words, anything that you want to wrap us up with here.
well, I just want to thank you. I mean, before we hit record, heard a little bit about your, drive to have this podcast, and just want to thank you too. I think the more we talk about it, just like with anything, addiction, has a stigma around it, right? Like, there's a lot of things out there that are really, really hard to talk about. So there needs to be more people like you out there who are willing to have uncomfortable conversations so that people don't feel alone. 'Cause like you said, we came, we're in this together, we need each other. Humans are wired for connection. And at the end of the day, like one of my favorite quote, one of them anyways, is that we're all just walking each other home. So like,
Nice.
let's just lean in and be kind when and wherever possible. So thank you for the work that you do.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you're exactly right. It doesn't take long for us to see a world falling apart out there. So anything we can do to stitch people together and just hold on for the ride, right?
Right.
So
Thank
anyway, thanks for being here. And
you.
listeners, thanks for joining us on another episode here at the Grief Observe podcast. Again, I'll have Julie's information in the show description. And if you want to join me, just check out that show description as well and get the information. And I'd love to have you on to speak about your journey of grief. Have a great day, everyone.